SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a new 3D live video journal with interactive with discussion in association with SNI Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, is pleased to present another in the series of both SNI and SNI Digital on controversies in medicine. And this one is about the healthcare in crisis, a physician-driven examination of the healthcare crisis with a multidisciplinary panel representing the major providers of healthcare. Since the introduction of Medicare in 1965 in the USA, the practice of medicine has undergone the progressive central control of healthcare, with rising costs, declining ease of access, failing quality of care, shortage of physicians, and with increasing patient dissatisfaction. That's defined as a failure in any business. The change from the doctor-patient free market model to a government biomedical industry socialized model for medicine, with its distorted, centrally controlled market incentives, is basic to the failing healthcare system. This impending healthcare disaster is not discussed by political parties or organized medicine. Why? Yet everyone sees its progressive failure. What needs to be done? SNI Digital and SNI will be interviewing members of the parties involved in delivering healthcare in the USA to develop a solution to this desperate healthcare crisis in the USA and perhaps elsewhere. What are the facts? What is the truth? If you're interested in participating in this effort and want to be part of its meetings and its investigations, please send your name, email address, and contact number to Eric Nussbaum at NUSSB001@gmail.com. SNI Digital Controversies with Healthcare in Crisis, the Profound Failure of Socialized Medicine, will be presented to you in a number of parts. Part one is the demise of private practice. Part two, government-controlled pay for physicians, which is this program. Part three is malpractice. The patient comes last, a solution. Part four, the hospital's position. Part five, the insurer's story. Part six, big business in medicine. Part seven, the biomedical pharmaceutical industry and healthcare. Part eight, can politicians solve this crisis? Part nine, is the patient responsible for their health? Part 10, academia, its failures and its potential. Part 11, the role of paramedical personnel. Part 12, is healthcare a God-given, unalienable right? Part 13, quality physician shortage, why? Part 14, the solutions to this healthcare crisis as developed in this series of programs. This program is developed to the topic of healthcare in crisis, part two, how central control and socialization are destroying the practice of medicine, socialized payment schemes for physicians. The participants in this program are Eric Nussbaum, who's the chair of the National Brain Aneurysm and Tumor Center, Directory of Complex Cranial Neurosurgery, Midwest Spine and Brain, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and the Associate Editor-in-Chief of Surgical Neurology International and a board member of SNI Digital and a former faculty member at the University of Minnesota in neurosurgery. This is a sample of some of Dr. Nussbaum's publications, which are books available in Amazon.com, Theme.com, and as publishers. And in addition, he has multiple scientific publications in PubMed and in SNI. The other contributor is James I. Ousman, MD, PhD. He's the CEO of SNI and SNI Digital. If you'd like to participate in this effort to reform the healthcare system, please write or contact Nussbaum, Eric Nussbaum at nussb001@gmail.com.
Eric, can you tell us a little bit about your background and so that the audience can know?
Yeah, so thanks so much, Jim, for inviting me to speak with you today. I'm a neurosurgeon with a specialty expertise in vascular and skull base. I did my training at the University of Minnesota with Roberto Harros. I had the privilege of spending some time up in London, Ontario, with the excellent neurosurgeons there, and it was at the very end of Dr. Drake's time there. Then I came back. I was on the full-time faculty at the University of Minnesota, again, doing vascular and skull base for about 6 years, and then started my own practice in the Twin Cities, focusing again on just vascular and skull base. And I've been doing that for 25 years or so. You and I have been talking a little bit about what's wrong with the current healthcare system and why physicians are so frustrated and having so much difficulty. And you challenged me with coming up with some specific areas that represent the core problem. And, you know, from my perspective, we could spend all day talking about a variety of issues, but the problem that I came up with that I think is most detrimental and disheartening is the way in which physicians are paid. And so that's what I thought we could spend a little time discussing today, how we are reimbursed for the work that we do. Obviously, as a neurosurgeon, I'm coming at it from the perspective of a neurosurgeon, a surgical subspecialist, but obviously I talk to a lot of my colleagues and hear some of the same issues crossing specialties and subspecialties.
Okay, that's very good. Just there are some people in the audience who I'm sure don't understand what's the payment system, but in normal commerce, between two people, there's a person who has a product and there's a person who wants to buy the product. And there's usually a discussion between the two of them, and they come to some agreement on what is the price, and that's market-driven, basically. That's market-driven economy, right?
Absolutely.
And so if people are assuming that that's how healthcare in the United States exists and how it's performed, I think the fundamental answer to begin with is it doesn't work that way. That system used to be in place when my father was a doctor, and he would have a fee and he'd look at the family and they would come to some agreement about what this would cost. And he would decide if he wanted to give his services away free or he was going to charge. And this was part of the reason that the doctors were so revered, because they were believed to be fair and so forth. But that's not the system you're going to talk about, right?
Right. That's absolutely not the system. And I think that that gets to really one of the fundamental problems. And one point that I would make, it took me a little time to really be able to articulate some of these issues, because I would suggest that pretty much every physician practicing today has, for almost all of their career, been working within this particular system. And so we take it for granted. We just accept that this is the way it has to be. And I think that has led people to not question the system and to not maybe suggest a fundamental change. But let me talk for a minute about how it works, just to step back in terms of what happens. So I'll see a patient in the office, and let's say that I think that they need to have surgery, and that the patient agrees. So the first step is that we have to go to the insurance company and submit a prior authorization. So we have to ask the insurance company if they'll pay for that surgery. And this is a process that all physicians are familiar with. It can take a day, or it can take a week, or many weeks, and the insurance company may never authorize the surgery. So there's a certain amount of effort that goes into it from a physician's office in order to get approval from the insurance company to authorize that surgery. Now, once that surgery is authorized, we schedule the surgery, and then we perform the surgery, and hopefully everything goes well with the surgery. Now, there's a few things that need to be said. First of all, and I'm going to spend some time on the relative value units that you mentioned and some of the other issues that come into play. But it's important to recognize that if you read the fine print on the prior authorization, the insurance companies always say prior authorization is not a guarantee of payment. So even though they've authorized the surgery, they may not pay you afterwards. I think there's probably a misconception that after the surgery, somehow a physician is paid in a reasonable time fashion, but it may not happen. And I can give you multiple specific examples, including, you know, a patient from several years ago who had a giant aneurysm. The prior authorization went through no problem. And then when we went to submit the bill after the surgery, the insurance company came back and said, the patient has met their lifetime benefit. You can't get paid for it. And once we have a contract with insurance companies, which pretty much all physicians do today, you can't bill the patient. So even though the surgery was authorized, there's absolutely no way to collect any money for that surgery after doing, you know, what was a lot of work. And the patient was as upset as I was in a case like that.
Can I just interrupt you for a question?
Sure. Sure.
Because you said at the outset when you were saying this that initially we said the relationship was between the buyer and seller of the product. But then you said when Medicare came in, or what happened is that the insurance companies, and this was the first example of it, came between the buyer and seller. And the insurance companies were the ones who were paying the money, no longer was the customer. And that came out because after World War II, there were some price controls and wage controls. And so what companies did is to compensate their workers, give them the compensation extra in providing them with health care, which comes through those insurance companies. So at that point, and that took over as a way of giving them extra money to avoid the wage growth situation at the time. So at that point, introduced becomes the first third party in what was a two-party negotiation for centuries, right?
Right. Absolutely.
But when that happened, the customer became divorced from the doctor or the seller, and somebody else was there regulating the sale and regulating what the compensation would be. Is that correct? Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Okay, now, then what we do is get into what you're saying, because you're right. What happened is everybody now is basically born into this new system and accepts it. But that wasn't what it has been established over time. And that isn't what happens in business and transactions everywhere in the world. If you're a farmer, or if you're a worker in some organization, or if you're an owner of a business, it always is a two-party negotiation.
Right. So that's perfect. That's a perfect transition to my next, you know, part of this, which is, so I submit a bill to the insurance company. And how do I submit a bill? What happens is there are a list of codes. They're known as CPT codes, or current procedural terminology codes. These were introduced in the 1960s, originally by the AMA, as a response to Medicare, which had been introduced shortly before that. And it was a way of listing out the services that physicians were providing. Over time, and this happened, started really in the 1970s and was more formally codified in the 1980s, they established a RVU, or relative value unit, relative value for these different procedures. Now, it's important to know that in some of the surgical subspecialties like neurosurgery, not all the things we do are well represented by those codes. They weren't always established by neurosurgeons or sophisticated neurosurgeons. That's a separate problem. But practically speaking, what that means is if I do a surgery, then I submit the codes and their number codes that represent that particular surgery. For example, if I do a carotid endarterectomy, the code for that is 35301, and I have to submit that code to the insurance company. And the insurance company knows that 35301, you'd have to look it up exactly based on last year's assessment, but it's probably around 33 relative value units. That's compared to other surgeries, and I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to get into this a little bit, which have different relative value units. But the insurance company basically will then look at the charge that's been submitted, and then they will decide whether they want to pay that charge or not. They may deny the charge. They may say, well, we don't want to pay it for all kinds of reasons. They may deny it. They may ask you to submit records, operative notes, other medical records. They often will tie us up for months, sometimes years, before they may pay that. They may never pay it. It's a very difficult process through a series of appeals, even though, again, we had a prior authorization which said that they had approved the procedure. They accepted that the procedure should be done, but now they're going to make you prove that you did what you said you did and that it was fully indicated and back that up. Ultimately, if they choose to pay it, which most of the time they do, I mean, it'd be reasonable, most of the time they do eventually get paid, but it can be a very painful process and it can take hours and hours on the phone and with paperwork for back office personnel and for the surgeon also, or for the physician, in order to finally get paid. So then eventually, based on those RVUs, those relative value units, the insurance company will pay you a set fee per relative value unit. So for example, in the example that I gave with carotid endarterectomy, if the insurance company is paying, for example, Medicare may pay around $30 per RVU, and you have about 30 RVUs, you may get paid $900 or $1,000 for a carotid endarterectomy. Now, this comes to what you said, because in any other profession, any that I know of, in any other field that I know of, a number of things happen when a customer is coming to either purchase goods or purchase services. The first thing that happens is that there's a discussion and an agreement as to what the fee will be, what will be charged for those goods or for that service upfront. There can be some negotiation. But at the end, you basically know what you're going to get paid. Now, as most patients know, as physicians know, these insurance companies, there are so many sub-plans, sub-types of plans. Sometimes Blue Cross is acting on behalf of Medicare. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes there are supplemental plans. There's no way for me to know before I do that operation that I know of exactly what I will be paid ultimately. So that's unique. Second of all, because the payment is simply based on relative value units, I can't charge more and I can't charge less. So that in a surgeon, a neurosurgeon, for example, who's been working for 25 years and has a lot of experience, let's say that my subspecialty is really brain aneurysm surgery, and I've operated on many thousands of brain aneurysms in my career. I will be paid by the insurance company the exact same amount as a neurosurgeon who finished their residency yesterday, who's doing that operation. And there's no way I can be paid more. There really is no recourse. I can't appeal to the insurance company. I can't do anything about that. So that's exactly right. The free market system has been destroyed. Another analogy would be, let's say that you have a car and you want to have it repaired. So normally you would go and you would probably go on the internet and look up some of the shops, or you might have a shop where you know that there's someone good, or you might ask your friends and you find out that there's one particular person Jim is the best mechanic in town, and that's who you want to take your car to, especially for a particular car type. And so you go in, and what happens? Well, Jim takes a look at your car. He gives you an estimate. He says, I can fix it for $2,000. And then you say, that's a lot of money, but okay, that's what Jim will charge. Now, it could be that there's a less experienced mechanic who'll do it for $1,000, and maybe Jim has priced himself too high, and you might choose to go there. But for Jim to fix it, you're going to have to go ahead with the $2,000. Now, Jim might start fixing it, and when he gets in there, he might call you up and say, you know what, it's a lot more complicated than I thought what we were going to find. It's actually going to be a little more. And you have the opportunity to say, yeah, go ahead. Or you can say, no, just close up and I'll take it somewhere else. I don't want to pay that much. Because Jim might say, look, I'd love to fix it for you for $1,000, but I'm actually losing money by the time I have to pay my secretaries and my other people in the shop. I can't make money if I'm only getting paid $1,000 or even $2,000. I'm going to have to charge you more. So then if you want it fixed by the person who is known to be the best, you pay it. Now, that is a perfecting market. That is a capitalistic market. That's a free market, but we don't have that in medicine at all because Jim has no choice. He has a contract with a third party that the car owner is involved with that says, number one, you need to fix the car. And number two, when you do, you're only going to get paid X based on our scale. But we're not even going to tell you before exactly how much we're going to pay you. And we're not even going to tell you for sure that you're going to get paid. And that's why I like to say that with the insurance companies, they pay you if they want, when they want, and how much they want. So it's an almost impossible situation. If you think of the physician as a business owner, in our examples, you think of the physician as having nurses and secretaries and that they have to pay and malpractice insurance and other costs that they have to cover. And then you think about they have to pay for that based on the amount of money that they generate, the revenue that comes in from the work that they do. And then you have to pay taxes and all these other things that we do. We're getting into situations where no one can run a business if you perform a service and then you're not sure, number one, if you're ever going to get paid. You have to go through a series of appeals for denials and you may never get paid. Number two, you don't know what you're going to get paid because you can kind of guess that for the surgery to do that carotid endarterectomy, you're going to get 900 or 1,000. But there might be something specific about this patient's situation where you're only going to get paid $400 or $500. And then finally, you don't know when. You might not get paid for 9 months. Nobody can really run a business that way. It's just not viable. And when you put that together, you start to understand why, at least in neurosurgery and in other fields of medicine, most physicians are now becoming employed as opposed to having their own independence. And people think that employment has always been there. People think, for example, that, well, if you were working at a university, you were always employed. That's not true. When I started at the University of Minnesota on the full-time faculty, we had our own private practice. That changed while I was on the faculty. And to then be an employee where people can tell you what you're going to do, how to take care of patients, these types of things, this is not an area of conversation for today, but I think it's so demoralizing and it undercuts the reason most of us went into medicine, which was to take care of patients and that satisfaction of having that relationship, that it comes back to the way in which we're paid as driving physicians into situations that are simply untenable. Because again, I can't set my fee where I want it. That is set for me. And we'll talk in a minute about these CPT codes and the relative value units and how they don't always make sense or they often don't make sense. But you can't change your fee. You can't be paid properly based on experience. And this is all on the backdrop of at a time when the hospitals are being paid generally well for the facility fee, which has been completely divorced from the payment to the physician. So this is a tough situation for physicians, and I think has made it extraordinarily difficult to make a living based on the professional fees that come in through the insurance companies.
Excellent example, using the mechanic and so forth. I think the audience is now beginning to get the appreciation that the original contract, it's a contract between the seller and the buyer, has now been totally broken. We have one third party that was introduced, which is insurance company. Now you've introduced a second third party, which is a hospital. And how did the hospital get into this? Well, the insurance company pays the hospital because that's where you had to go because of your illness. And the insurance company may say, you can't go to that hospital. You have to go to another hospital because I've negotiated lower reimbursement rates with them. Or you go to that hospital because it's good and so forth and so on. And the insurance company in the hospital says, well, because I'm giving you a lot of good services. I was in a hospital a month or two ago. I went to the emergency room. They were flush with personnel. I mean, they provided wonderful service, but they had probably too many personnel. They did it in a way, I'm sure, because it was an emergency room and they wanted to have people around. But you're paying for all that. And before, whether it was a doctor-patient relationship, now we've got the insurance company and we've got the hospital into this equation. And you, in the doctor, where is the doctor? Where is this agreement we had? And is that an accurate portrayal of how the system is being corrupted?
It absolutely is an accurate portrayal. You have basically a situation where the insurance companies have been squeezed. They are for profit, most of them. They're trying to make money. We know, again, this is beyond the scope, I think, of today. We can have many conversations about this, but the insurance companies, after basically because of the Affordable Care Act, because of Obamacare, are forced to take patients with certain pre-existing conditions and people who have wait to get insurance until they have a catastrophic issue. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that patients who have pre-existing conditions don't deserve care. They do. But putting them onto the private insurance situation has created problems for the insurance companies also. Nevertheless, the insurance companies seem to be doing pretty well for themselves. But you have the insurance companies and you have the hospitals and the really wild growth of hospital administrators and the physicians. And instead of working together to try to provide care for the patients, you've got essentially them working against each other is the way it feels. At least it's the way it feels to the physician, in that the hospital is trying to cut as many corners and save as much money as they can. And they're trying to protect the dollars that come to them from the insurance companies. The physicians are barely making enough money for the work that they do. And the insurance companies are for-profit corporations in general, with shareholders and executives who are, you know, seem to be doing pretty well. But so their goal is to make money. And that is not in keeping with taking care of patients some of the time, which puts us into all of the problems that we can talk about at another session about, you know, expensive care, end of life care, you know, these types of things, which are becoming extraordinarily problematic within healthcare today. And so we've lost a free market economy, and we have lost autonomy, and we have interposition, as you pointed out very correctly, between the physician and the patient, which is where the care really needs to be and needs to be delivered. And, you know, this is just a huge problem. I wanted to give you some examples, looking at the relative value of some of these CPT codes, where it just doesn't make sense. And this becomes problematic. This is obviously very specific to neurosurgery because that's what I know about, and in particular, brain surgery, cranial neurosurgery, which is what I do. But look, I mentioned to you carotid endarterectomy several times. The relative value of carotid endarterectomy is in the low 30s, the low 30 RVUs. If you look at some comparisons, the relative value for a stereotactic needle biopsy, and I don't want to get too detailed about what these procedures are, but it's basically a very quick procedure in which a needle is inserted into the brain to take a biopsy of an abnormality, let's say perhaps a tumor. It's a very quick operation. It's certainly less labor intense and much easier, I think, than a carotid endarterectomy, which includes opening the neck of the patient, isolating the carotid artery and its branches, stopping the flow temporarily to this artery, which is bringing blood supply to the brain, opening it, cleaning it out, closing it up, and then closing up the incision. That has relative value units in the low 40s. So it's worth more than a carotid endarterectomy. It's better reimbursed. If you look at craniotomy for a subdural hematoma, where there's a blood clot on the surface of the brain, not within the brain, the relative value units are in the 60s. So that's much more. Now, it could be that after an accident, you have a large hematoma and it requires a larger craniotomy of opening the skull. But it could also be that we're talking about a patient who has an older collection of blood, a subacute subdural hematoma, let's say, which can be operated through a small craniotomy at times, which I can do in, and you could probably do in 15 or 20 minutes. And it's a very easy operation. And now there's no distinction between different types of subdural hematomas and what we're paid. So now you're paid twice as much, essentially, to do that 15-minute operation to take out a small subdural hematoma as you are for doing a carotid endarterectomy. But where it gets really crazy is that if you have a blood clot in the brain, not on the surface, the CPT code is a 61313, and that is lower relative value units than a subdural hematoma where the clot is outside the brain. Now, somebody would have to explain to me how that makes any sense. It would never be easier, I don't think, to take out a blood clot where you have to enter the brain. And I mean, I can pull up multiple examples for you. There's a code, a 61526 code, which, again, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but it's a craniotomy for a cerebellopontine angle tumor through a transmastoid approach. It sounds very technical, but neurosurgeons will know what I'm talking about, and that's 100 relative value units. If you add on to that a middle fossa craniotomy as well, which makes it a 61530, if you put them together, the relative value units actually go down to 92 RVUs. So I can't imagine anyone, why would you ever use the higher code, the 61530 code, which is more work, but you get paid less. So my point is simply that this is a bad system and it doesn't reflect what we do, the work that we put in as neurosurgeons to these varying procedures, and it makes it impossible. An extracranial intracranial bypass, which was your specialty and one of my specialties, is only 77. It's barely more than a subdural hematoma. And that's a very intense operation requiring a lot of skill.
How do we compensate the fellow who has worked and spent his life and studied and traveled around the world to done a very complicated procedure and he's known worldwide and these things are behind all this was education, training, and lots of experience. But then there's a fellow who just comes in and establishes business and he doesn't have it. And so the insurance company says, well, it's a couch or it's an operation. I'm going to pay him the same amount of money. So now the fellow who has done all of the training, all the experience to get that, feels that he's not being rewarded for what he's doing. Why should I have done this? If I had known it beforehand, I wouldn't do this. So basically, you've totally ruptured the capitalistic system, the buyer and seller relationship, and it's no longer based on any experience or any value. And then I was going to get to, you told me a lot of different codes. Who makes these codes up? And or it's like the mechanic. You take your car to the mechanic. Yes, it costs you more, but you get it. You know the car works. You take it to somebody else, you got another problem. You're back there in a month. Our viewers can understand this, and the people are going to look at it. This becomes almost impossible. What happens to the fellow who's now trained and done all this stuff to do the very best mechanic it can be and the very best work in the world? I, if I had known this, I'd have gone into some other profession where it's not going to be regulated by the government.
Okay, well, let's give some practical examples. So in 2002, I purchased for my growing family an SUV, and I paid $35,000 for it.
Okay.
And if I go today to that, the same vehicle is still being produced by the same manufacturer. Hopefully it has some additional bells and whistles today, but the same vehicle essentially today is $110,000 if I want to buy that vehicle. So from 2002 to 2024, 2025, tripled, let's say, in terms of the cost. Now, the amount that I am being paid for my services as a neurosurgeon has been decreased by more than 50% over that same period of time. I'm not aware that other professions, I'm not aware that lawyers are being paid less, in part because they set their fee. I'm not aware that mechanics are being paid less than they were. They've been able to increase their fees along with increasing cost of living, increases, that type of thing. But as physicians, we have not been able to do that. Our salaries or reimbursements have come down. Now, it's possible that society felt that we were making too much money. That's a separate conversation. But the point is that this lack of a free market, this lack of a free market economy has major effects on physicians and on surgical subspecialists. Now, if you look at that mechanic, what would happen if a third party said to him, well, if you're going to be rebuilding that engine on that car, we'll let you know afterwards what we'll pay you. You kind of might have a general sense again. So let's say that mechanic goes and he says, like, okay, well, I need the work. I have to work. I have to make money. I want to take care of patients. And so he goes ahead and does it. And so they end up paying that mechanic. Let's say 6 months later, after a lot of back and forth, he gets a check in the mail for $900. Now, that same company may tell him that to change out a headlight, he's going to get paid $1,100. There's part of what I was trying to show is that part of the whole problem is that none of it really makes sense. Now, there's the relative values as they were set by, you know, by the, well, the original CPT codes were by the AMA, and the relative values came later. But the way they're set, they don't all often make sense. They don't work well for physicians. They're not truly reflective of the work that we do, and we have no way to overcome that. You can't fight this system is really the problem. And I apologize if I got into too much detail.
But No. It was fine. And so what you're really saying here, this is that we've gotten into a situation here, which is what happens in socialized anything, where you have a third party who comes in and basically they control all the market. They control how much each party is paid. They collect the money. The third party is doing this. And instead of a free market system where the market adjusts to what the demand and supply is, this is set by some central organization that doesn't know Eric Nussbaum from Joe Stone over here. And it's not relevant to you. And that's what happens in a government-controlled economy, is that there's maldistribution, there's disproportionate payments, because some payments, I knew the senator and he voted for this and he got me a higher payment for this instead of the next guy who didn't have so much influence. And so you're into a system where it's no longer fair. It's controlled by other factors. And then I'm going to add the final factor in. And the final factor is, gee whiz, I find that the expenses I'm paying as a government for healthcare are just going up all the time. And that's because you now not only have the buyer and seller, but you introduce the third party as the insurer. Then you introduce the fourth party, who's another third party, which is the hospital, and then comes in, well, you've got to have some rehabilitation therapy, and then you need somebody else. And then we've got an instrument company that says, to need this, you're going to have to use this instrument out there, and they're charging that. And so the government says, unfortunately, fellas, I only have $1 million a year to spend on healthcare. And so where am I going to cut? Well, I could cut the business. I get a lot of lobbying power there. They have much more lobbying power than you do. I could cut the reimbursement to the patient, but he doesn't pay for it anymore. The company does. So I can say to the company, I'll raise your premium. Well, this company said, I can't afford to be in business if I do that. So who does he go to? He says, I'm going to cut the doctor. I'm going to cut his pay. And you know, by the way, doctors drive expensive SUVs, and everybody knows they make a lot of money, but they don't know that their income has been reduced. And this next year, it's going to be reduced by 2.8%. And they just put it in Congress, and Congress refused to rescind that. So it's going to go through almost 3% cut. And it's been going on every year for that, right? So what I've tried to do now is to bring it into practical terms. And what we've had, unfortunately, is socialized medicine, government-controlled medicine, centrally controlled medicine, which has resulted in all the things that you're talking about, inappropriate payment schemes that have nothing to do with the service that you're providing or the value of the service. It's determined centrally, and the system is progressively having more and more costs, and it means that the doctors are getting paid less, the patients, so doctors want to go into medicine, patients are getting less service, and they're being exposed to all these third parties who don't really care very much about the patient. They just want to make money. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. And don't forget, if you talk to your patients, so I talk to my patients when they come and see me, if you talk to your patients, with all the money that's being spent, the majority of them are not happy with the care that they're getting.
Right.
So it's not as though the doctors are getting stuck with lower reimbursements, but everything is working great and the patients are getting great care. The point is that it's not working well. The patients are not getting great care, in part because the physicians are being handcuffed. We're not able to deliver the care the way we want to deliver it, working in multidisciplinary teams, interfacing with our colleagues. Most physicians barely have time, you know, to do the care that they want because of documentation issues and dealing with these appeals and prior authorizations. So it simply isn't working for anyone. Maybe it's working for the insurance companies, but anyone who thinks that the goal here should be socialized medicine, we're already there. We've been there for a long time. They just did it quietly, and we didn't realize that it was happening. It's just now becoming truly evident, I think, to people who are waking up and saying that this is simply not a sustainable situation. And I think they're preying on taking advantage of the fact that most physicians went into medicine not to make a lot of money, but to take care of patients. And so most of us, including myself, accepted it when our salaries started to go down. The problem is that now we can't any longer take care of patients well. And that was really where they made the mistake. They broke the straw, they broke the camel's back with the last straw, because it wasn't just about the amount of money that we were able to make. I think most of us want to make a good living and be able to provide for our families. But I wasn't here talking to you 10 years ago when my salary had come down 15%, let's say, or 20% by that point. I'm talking to you now because in addition to the fact that my salaries continue to come down, I can't deliver the care that I want to anymore because I can't afford to pay my nurses and pay my malpractice and cover my overhead and still provide the services that I want, because the insurance companies have very much become, and the hospitals have become, intertwined in this process. And essentially, they're practicing medicine. They're telling us who we can operate on, when we can operate on them, when we should stop care for patients. I mean, we have a very, very dire situation at this point. Your assessment is correct. And I mean, I'm not trying to be Chicken Little, but, you know, to some degree, the sky is falling. I mean, we have a very, very serious problem here in terms of the way we deliver healthcare and how we can talk about, you know, options for how to move forward. But I don't believe that this can continue. We can no longer accept what you know, government, I think, and some of the insurance companies would like patients to believe, which is that all physicians are equal. It doesn't matter who you go to. It doesn't matter if somebody's had 25 years of experience or one day of experience. None of this matters. I think people know that this makes no sense, but people don't know what to do about it. And now patients are getting caught in the middle. And now quality of outcomes is really, I think, beginning or is already suffering.
Well, I think it's an excellent summary. And I think there's a couple of things we should add, and then we should go into what suggestions you have to fix this system. As we take this system further, what we find out is that in order that people are leaving the practice of medicine, they're getting what's called burned out because they have too much paperwork to do, to fill out for the insurance company, which they never had before. They don't get paid for it. The insurance company forces the doctor to pay for it. So you have to hire more people to process and do all these things and fill out the forms. Usually that wasn't very much of a cost at all. It was very simple and you did it. Okay, so now we've got that system, and now we've got a system where it's not as attractive for physicians anymore. So they're trying to make it a decision where to go to have a life. All of a sudden, the equation has changed. 40 years ago, I was accused of making too much money. Now I'm in a situation where I'm losing money virtually every year, and I don't have any control out of it. So now all of a sudden, well, you're dedicating your life to medicine. We have our opponents are arguing two different sets of standards here. And the reason that what's changed is the system is destroying the doctor who's delivering the service. And so what we see, we had a failure rate of the first year medical students in a major university in this country. In the first year, 50% failed their first year. Never happened before. So it means the quality of people coming into the profession is decreasing. Well, what's the fundamental reason that somebody, Aaron, my life is at stake, my wife is ill, I've got three kids, and this is a deathly illness, I want to go to the best person I can find in the world. That's the person who makes the best couches. That's the person who's the best mechanic, but I can't go there. And how do I feel? I'm miserable. So I try to make it up with what I can do, and I don't have enough because I'm trying to struggle and make it in an inflationary economy also. So, I mean, this is a dire situation. The doctor's not happy. The patient's not happy because he doesn't have time for him anymore because he's spending too much time filling out forms. And he's programmed that you can only spend 15 minutes with the patient because now the business owns a practice. And the business says, you got to work 15 minutes with this patient and every other patient so we can make enough money. And you never did that before. You said, well, if the patient needs more money, more time, I'll give them more time. And as in the free market economy, you say, I'll take the hit myself. That was your right as a seller. And that's a seller as a mechanic or a seller so far. Somebody comes to the mechanic. He says, you know, Joe, I don't have it. Can you find a way to do for it? And you say, look, Joe, forget it. I'll take care of it. Give me $25 and we'll take care of it. And that's it. You had that right. You don't have that right anymore. So now what we've taken is this system, and it's reached the point of basic means the system can't make it anymore. So good people are leaving. So the person who wants the best for his family can't get them, and they aren't distinguished anyway. And it's a distressing, if you're a patient, it's a distressing situation. I love my wife, my kids, and I don't want my wife to die. And I've told me it's a very bad circumstance. And I know I want the best person to take care of it. And you can't have it. Well, where did that happen? This is the free market economy has been destroyed, and no longer what you want is you're available, and the doctors aren't going into the profession anymore. Why should they? I can go and become a lawyer. You don't have this in law. You don't have this in any other business in the country except utilities. where the government sets what you're going to get and you get no more. And they keep cutting it. They don't do that in utilities, but they do that to doctors. Why? Because doctors don't unite and say it's enough already. But they're telling you by voting with their feet, I'm leaving and I'm quitting the profession. And so now we're left with a shortage of 1,200 neurosurgeons next year in the United States. We used to have 3,500 and our population's increasing. We can't take care of all this. So now the question is, do you have anything you want to add to that? Because I think we need to go to what suggestions do you have? And they may be draconian. They may be very major. But basically, we've taken the two-party negotiation between a buyer and seller. We've introduced all kinds of third parties in there who are taking up the money. And the whole system is coming apart because of it. And if you talk to patients, you talk to people in healthcare, they say, I don't know what to do about it. I can't fix it. And it keeps going right downhill. And the patients are suffering. So what suggestions? How do we fix this?
Well, I think you have a broken system and you can put as many Band-Aids on it as you want, but it's not going to work. It's only going to get worse. And you know, again, getting back to when you asked me to think about what is wrong with the system, what are the fundamental problems? I think the way physicians are reimbursed and all the, you know, and all the resulting issues that we've talked about today just no longer work. And I think we have to change the system fundamentally. This whole CPT system, RVU system, where it's arbitrarily imposed upon physicians, where there's no free market, has to end. Now, exactly how that looks, we could talk about that. We'd have a whole nother session and talk about how it looks. But I don't think that there is an easy patch to kind of repair this. And again, I think it's hard for physicians to think about because we grew up in this system. But there are analogous examples. And again, this would be a whole nother conversation. But during my time as a physician, we went from paper charts to electronic medical records. People think electronic medical records are great. They're absolutely horrible. If you open a hospital chart, it might be for a week long stay, it might be 2,000 pages of which only 10 are actually important or relevant. Right. And as a physician trying to take care of that patient, it can be impossible to get to the relevant information and the amount of charting, I want to call it paperwork, but it's not paperwork. It's sitting at a computer in order to meet all the requirements and do all the things that you need to do is crazy. You know, if you ask me, I would throw out the electronic medical record. It has some benefits, but it has far more issues. And we could go back to the way it was, and I think it would be great. Well, I think we need to take a look at how it ran before we started paying physicians based on relative value units for CPT codes, where physicians were not allowed to set their fee schedules. I think we need to go back to a time where physicians could set their fees and work directly with patients. And the insurance companies were not interposed in between physicians and patients, but patients purchased insurance. And when they needed it, the insurance company would have to pay. And something along those lines. I don't really see an easy compromise position. I think there might be some intermediate options, but they would all entail dramatic changes to the system that put the physicians back in charge of the payment model.
I agree. So here, we can make some statements. The first thing is we have to call it what it is. We are now experiencing the end of socialization of medicine. And the end has resulted in a system that's on the verge of collapse for all the people involved. And the socialization of medicine was based on everybody has the right to have equal health care. Well, all of a sudden, healthcare became a right. Well, do I have a right to have a house? Do I have a right to have a car? Do I have a right to have free schooling? At some point, there's a certain amount that you have to pay for it by yourself. And that you do this, and that's your incentive in life to get a better job, to perform better, and to do something better. What we developed is a system in medicine called credit card medicine. The patient no longer has to care about what the costs are. He goes and he gives a credit card to the doctor. The doctor then uses the credit card, and the payment is between the employer and the insurance company and all the hospital and all these other people. The patient's out of the system. Only thing he has to do is get the forms done, and now he's defaulted that to the doctor. So the doctor winds up fighting for him. The patient has already been treated. Now the other people are fighting for what money is left. It's not working. Well, there's one ingredient we missed, and that is we have credit card medicine. 50% of the people in our country are overweight, obese, morbid obesity, 50%. If I was going to ask you, if I took 1,000 people who are basically normally slim and so forth, and it took 1,000 people who are obese, who are in this category, 50% of whom were obese, what do you think the longevity is? How long are they going to live in the first category where they've taken care of themselves versus the second category? I don't have to do a major study to answer that question. The death rate in the study with the morbidly obese people is going to be extremely high, and their costs for healthcare are going to be high because they're going to consume it. Why? Because there's no incentive to lose weight or to take care of health. So the first one of the first primary parts of this system that's missing is, what is the patient's responsibility for healthcare? It isn't do whatever you want to do, go have drugs or go or live wildly or drive and have some serious accident and put your card in and you get paid for it. That means everybody else has to pay for it. That's unfair. So now you have a responsibility. Just like you have a responsibility if you want to have a house or you want to have a car. If you don't take care of a car, you go to the car company. The car says, if you don't bring the car in for 1,000 miles or 2,000 or 4,000 or 5,000, I can't guarantee you that the car is going to work, and you're not going to get support from the company for the parts that have degenerated because you misused it and you didn't take care of it. We could have prevented this. We don't do that in medicine. We tell them, you go do whatever you want, give a credit card to somebody, spend as much money as you want, because that's what you're doing, spending my money. And in the end, somebody will pay for it. First thing is we've got to introduce patient responsibility. Second thing is, if we don't introduce, and I'm just starting, you can add in, if we don't incentivize the smartest and best people to come into healthcare, because the fundamental question you ask is, I want the very best person I can take care of, who can take care of my wife and my three kids, and she is seriously ill. And I want the very best person who can do that, who's going to guarantee me that I can do that. If to get those people, we have to attract very intelligent, competent people who have souls, who are compassionate. It takes a long time to train them. But that's the end key to the system. And if you don't have them, it falls apart, which is what we're seeing. Okay, that's second number two. If you don't want to have the best people take care of you, forget it. So that means their compensation has to be at a level that's going to make it rewarding. I'm not saying everybody has to make what a major league ball player gets, and I think they get too much money, but I think it's obvious it's not working this way, right? So I've got an erector system that does that. The RVU system, socialized medicine system, has to go. It doesn't work. You can't make that work with a socialized system. Well, you can say, well, people ought to go into medicine because they ought to be well-motivated. Well, I can be well-motivated and become a computer scientist. The heck with that? So, and it takes a long time to train. I mean, I wasn't out until 30. I was 35 years old. A third of my life is gone. So, patients have to be responsibility. We got to throw socialized medicine out. It's failing. I don't care what you call it. It's socialized medicine, and that means another model, fee for service. Oh, we can't have that. Well, there is no other alternative to socialism but free market economy. Well, if we do that, the whole system's going to fall apart. Well, Maybe that's what we're going to have, because any other alternative now is just what you said, a band-aid on something that's failing. A patient who's come in bleeding from every pore, and all you're doing is putting band-aids on, and that's going to fail. And that's what we're into. So that's the basis. And that with that, our view system gets thrown out the window. If you're an experienced neurosurgeon and you've done these complicated operations and your results, which are known and published and everybody knows it, and you've had enormous success, you ought to get compensated for what you do. And if you're just out of practice, you can't say that. So somebody has to make the decision, well, I'll go with this person because that's all I can afford. Well, does that mean everybody doesn't get equal health care? It's going that way anyway. Right now, if we keep doing this, we're going to have two-tier healthcare. And one tier is going to be what the government pays, and then the other tier is going to be what people want to do, and they want to pay extra to get the best care. And that's happening all over the world. So it's already happening by default, but the government wants to regulate it. So would you want to make any other suggestions at this point? I mean, those between the two of us, I think you'd agree with them, are the overwhelming recommendations, right?
Yeah, I would 100% agree. I mean, you know, I think patient responsibility is part of restoring the patient-doctor contract that you spoke of, the patient-doctor relationship, which used to be central to medicine and which has been removed from medicine. I think, you know, I would make the point that there is a complete misconception, and it's not a misconception by accident. It's been pushed by politicians. I think it's been pushed by a variety of lobbies, but that is that physicians take care of patients. If you look on TV, for example, you look in the movies, there's this idea that patients are dying because they can't get surgery or they can't get care. It's completely false. In this country, patients come in with urgent situations. Now, maybe preventative care may be harder to access, but if a patient has an urgent problem, a brain tumor, something else that's causing a lot of swelling or mass effect, you go into a hospital, they get taken care of. The physicians have to worry later about how they're going to get paid or how to figure that out. Uninsured patients, sometimes we never get paid. And I think physicians are fine with that. Physicians have no trouble doing, you want to call it pro bono work, you want to goodwill, doing the right thing for patients. We don't have any trouble. But once it is systematized and institutionalized to the point where that is the average, is that you're not getting paid properly, you're not being, and the problem is that it's pernicious. And you started to, I think when you talk about patient responsibility and autonomy, you're really getting to that point, which is we need to, in order to deliver financially efficient and reasonable care, we have to throw some of that back on the patients. You know, if you want, I always used to say, if you want to ride a motorcycle without a helmet, maybe that's your prerogative, but maybe your insurance costs should be higher to account for the fact that if you get in an accident, it's going to cost a lot of money to the taxpayer and to everybody involved to take care of you. If you want to smoke, I mean, I understand that smoking is an addiction and some people can't stop, and that maybe that's a little different than, you know, riding a motorcycle without a helmet. But we have to incentivize people to take good care of themselves, as you said. That's the only way that I think we can restore a balanced system that is financially viable. But I also think that if you want physicians who are the best and the brightest to go into medicine like we used to have, you have to restore a sense of pride and a sense of value and esteem to the profession. And you have to put physicians back in a position where they can take good care of patients, which has been completely taken away now. And again, for a lot of us, it's not about the bottom line of how many zeros are at the end of your paycheck. That's not what it's about. But it is about feeling that you're reasonably compensated for the work that you do, and that you're not part of a system that actually is not working to provide better health care for patients. It just makes no sense. There's other things we can talk about, but we need to restore merit-based advancement in medicine. You know, I think there's been this really very dangerous introduction of other criteria. We could have a whole nother conversation about this, but it really needs to return to being about merit, or else the best and the brightest are not interested. The best and the brightest lose interest very quickly when they're punished based on whatever, skin color, gender, political views, whatever it is. It has to be merit-based if you want the best and the brightest. And we've gotten away from that, and that's a huge problem.
Totally agree. So what we concluded is we have to have patient responsibility for their healthcare. We have to have merit-based performance, which is actually for what you're talking about is free market, and introduce that into healthcare. And that also relates to we have to select the best and the brightest. And that means that they will be compensated appropriately. It does fundamentally mean that there may be different levels of healthcare. Well, I just told you about a furniture guy who's got this extremely valuable antique furniture. Somebody wants to go there. Well, we all make those decisions. I don't think I can afford a $10,000 couch. I think I can get away with a $2,000 couch. I'll be able to sit in it and be comfortable. That's what I was looking for. The other one, a little luck nicer. Maybe I have to work harder, get more money. And then I can buy that in 10 years from now. So there has to be a rationale here that we can't, everybody can't have the moon and have the system work. So socialized medicine, we have to admit, fails. It will not work if you try to introduce this into the legal system. You never get off the ground or into any business. So why it got away with in medicine is because somebody said it was a right. It's not a right. It's a privilege. It's a privilege like you want to own a nice house or a nice car or something else. And for that privilege, you have to sacrifice and you have to also work to earn that privilege. And then you go to the people who are right. With that, we've got all these third parties involved. Well, they're out of the system. They have to come in a free market economy and tell me why we need their product and why that's going to be better and what the evidence is against other alternatives. And like in the marketplace, the one who has the most reasonable cost, a reasonable price, and still has value will win. And that will begin to regulate the companies. They'll go furious over it. And that also has to do with hospitals. People don't know when Medicare came in and they shifted a lot of the things the doctors did in their office to make it easier for patients, like x-rays and lab work and pharmaceuticals, that will let the hospital do it. And the hospital then was able to turn around and they would tell the government who was paying, the government's, I'll pay you 3% over costs. And any patient who looks at his bills today and says that an MR exam costs $2,000 or $3,000, I mean it's beyond comprehension. Or if you look up a bottle of Tylenol, it's $10. So it's the prices have gotten way out of line. If you look at the bill, several hundred thousand dollars for being in the emergency room for 6 hours is I can't, I can buy a part of a house for that. And I've just used it up in 12 hours. That's unreasonable. So we have to get the third parties also to understand this is a market-based economy. You have to prove the value. And there are other ways to do that. They have many products out there. We could have like a Consumer Reports that evaluates them and says, these products don't give you any more value from your money than product Z over here. And so you make the choice of what you want to do, not somebody else. So I think our fundamental principle here is get back to a market-driven economy and a market-driven healthcare system. Is it going to be convulsive? You're going to wind up there anyway.
I absolutely agree. And I think, I mean, the thing that I would just close with, and I mentioned it before, but is really, I think as part of the process, everybody needs to understand that most physicians are doing this to help patients. And so It's not about the money, and we're not going to let people fall through the cracks. If anything, more people are falling through the cracks now because we're no longer able to help them. As you know, a number of years ago, I published in Surgical Neurology our experience with setting up a program where we brought patients over from Africa and Ethiopia, patients who couldn't find care for their very complicated skull-based problems in Europe. They couldn't find it at other centers in North America, and they came to our center that where we took care of them. And it was I never received a dime, never received any payment for any of these patients that we took care of. But nevertheless, it was some of the most rewarding work that I did. It was totally life-changing for some of these patients, and there's extraordinarily grateful patients. I can't do that anymore. The hospital shut it down. The hospitals won't allow it to happen. And the other physicians, I would still do those cases for free, but I can't because our system is now running on such a razor-thin budget that the hospitals won't let us do it, and the other physicians who I had to work with won't let us do it. So we're not going to let people fall through the cracks. And I agree, healthcare should be viewed more of as a privilege, but with the proviso that if somebody has a problem and they can't get taken care of anywhere else, I think most physicians will step up and take care of those patients and do it even for free, if not at a reduced rate. So it's not as though I think some of the resistance that you'll hear will be politicians or insurance companies or people saying, like, well, then you're going to have people dying all over the place. And that's really, I think it's very unfair and very untrue. Because we just need a system where we can reattract the best and the brightest, and where physicians feel valued, and we can take care of patients the way we want to. And then we'll actually see better care of patients under those circumstances, not less or not worse care.
Just the last and closing a couple of comments. People thought that when hospitals got into groups, and that's going on all over the country and consolidated, that there would be several benefits. The first is the cost would go down. The evidence has shown that that didn't happen. The cost went up. The second reason to do that was that we need to be able to have records. If I go to hospital B and then I'm in another city and I get sick, they can't get my records. We were supposed to have, when we were sold this computer business, the ability to have free access to my records everywhere to essentially oppose all this duplication and triplication. That never happened. So, and then there was a third study saying, did you, by having all these different hospitals and satellites, has the quality of care improved, which is what they said they were going to do? The answer turned out it didn't improve. So there's a major issue in regarding to healthcare and hospitals here. They need to be in the competitive system. Well, I can't make it. I can't hire all these people. Maybe you hired too many people and you're paying too much money. What's happening now, when it's becoming very restrictive and inflation's going up and hospitals are paying money, who are they cutting? They're cutting administrative staff. Administrative staff doesn't produce patients. Doctors produce patients. So it's working in that respect. So I think that what we've said is that there are multiple systems that need to be fixed, but fundamental to all the systems is to reestablish free market competition and reward for what you do.
I agree.
There are some failed assumptions about healthcare which have been promoted for the last 60 years. Physicians make too much money. The fee-for-service model does not work. Healthcare is a right. Everyone should have healthcare using a credit card medicine. Lower costs can be achieved with centralized care. Better quality with standards of practice and central control. We will have uncorrupted science, randomized controlled trials, evidence-based medicine, all data-driven. There will be no government biomedical industry physician corruption. Examples of socialized medicine, distorted incentives, and failure. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem, or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. The statements of the participants in this program represent their personal opinions and do not necessarily reflect those of the Educational Foundation as sponsor. Please fill out your rating of this video on the homepage below the main video in the rating bar to help us improve our programming. The foundation supporting this programming and believes there are many ways to learn. SNI, Surgical Neurology International, is a 2D internet journal. Nancy Epstein is its editor-in-chief. Its web address is sni.global. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is a 3D video journal, which is interactive with discussion. Its web address is snidigital.org. And both journals are free 24/7, 365 to everyone everywhere. Surgical Neurology International has read in 239 territories and countries since 2010, as the third largest readership in neurosurgery. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is seen in 145 countries in 10 months after publication, and is a new all-video neurosurgery journal. It is the goal of the foundation to help people throughout the world. The foundation also has a medical news network, which is devoted to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. This program is copyrighted by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. It is an IRS USA 501c3 operating charitable foundation. All rights are reserved. Thank you for watching the program. We hope it's been helpful.